Now, from the KSFR Newsroom, At Noon looks at the top local news headlines for this Thursday, September 5th. Senator Tom Udall of New Mexico is among those on the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations voting to oppose a resolution authorizing military action in Syria. Still, the resolution passed the committee Wednesday by a vote of 10-7. Udall says that he's heard from hundreds of New Mexicans on the matter, the majority of them opposed to U.S. military involvement in Syria. Udall's vote was consistent with his previously stated opposition to sending heavy weapons to the Syrian rebels and further involving the U.S. in the Syrian civil war. PNM's plan to shut down two of its four coal-fired units at the San Juan Generating Plant near Farmington will be presented to the state's Environmental Improvement Board today. PNM first announced back in February its plans to bring San Juan into compliance with a federal visibility rule. If the Environmental Improvement Board approves it, the proposal then goes to the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. If accepted there, the two units could be retired by the end of 2017. And we'll have more on this story for you a bit later as At Noon continues. Progressive advocacy group Progress Now New Mexico has launched a public effort to raise money for a legal defense fund for the Doña Ana County clerk facing suit by Republican legislators seeking to stop his issuance of same-sex marriage licenses. County Clerk Lynn Ellen says he has already incurred about $10,000 in preparatory legal fees in anticipation of the lawsuit filed by Republican State Senator Bill Scherer of Farmington and others. In just the last 2 weeks, seven counties have issued same-sex marriage licenses to some 500 couples. Meanwhile, Grant County will begin issuing such licenses next week. As the New Mexico Legislative Health and Human Services Committee meets today in Las Cruces, local and national oral health experts are testifying in support of using dental therapists to ameliorate the effects of the state's chronic shortage of dentists. The state ranks 39th worst in the U.S. for dentists per capita, with some 63% of our population without nearby access. Advocates are proposing that dental therapists be employed to work under the supervision of an off-site dentist in the state's most underserved communities. Supporters want to lobby the state legislature to make such an effort part of the next session's agenda. A psychiatrist whose Medicaid payments were suspended by the state's Human Services Department back in early 2012 has had a state district court judge rule that he be granted a hearing on fraud allegations. The judge made his motion Wednesday that Dr. Babik Mirren is entitled to know what information the HSD gave to the Attorney General and then offer rebuttal. Today's Albuquerque Journal reports that the Human Services Department's legal representative is inclined to appeal the ruling, saying the sharing of the information would negatively affect the criminal investigation. Dr. Mirren's case is not among the more recent stop payment actions to 15 in-state providers of mental health and substance abuse services. The 89th annual burning of Zozobra takes place tonight at Santa Fe's Fort Marcy Park. As usual, the event is expected to draw tens of thousands to that part of town, beginning at 2 p.m. when the gates open. There are many road closures and detours in effect. A new prohibition this year is the barring of pedestrian and vehicle traffic on Artist Road starting at 5 p.m. from Fort Marcy Park East to Avenida Primera South. Also, pedestrians will not be allowed to loiter along the road to watch the show. A full list of other closures and restrictions can be found on the city's website. And weather for Santa Fe. Mostly sunny skies with highs in the mid-80s today through Sunday. Little to no chance for any precipitation until some monsoonal moisture returns to our area next week. And the current Santa Fe temperature now 80 degrees. This is Dan Garrity for KSFR News. At Noon will continue in just a moment.
Support comes from New Mexico Educators Federal Credit Union, where the more you participate in your not-for-profit financial cooperative, the more money you earn. For details on Earn Your Return, go to nmefcu.org or visit their branch on St. Michael's Drive.
And At Noon on KSFR now segues to today's feature stories. The State Environmental Improvement Board is meeting in Farmington today. In attendance is PNM, our state's largest electric utility, presenting its plans for the closure of two of four coal-fired units at the San Juan Generating Station. It's a proposal to meet air quality and visibility mandates put in place by the Environmental Protection Agency. Joining us now to talk more about this is Paul Shipley, PNM spokesperson. Paul, today's hearing has been some time in the making, with initial proposals refashioned over time as compromises to very strict regulations first sought by the Environmental Protection Agency. Give us the overview.
First, Dan, it's not actually PNM's plan. It's what's called a State Improvement Plan, and you'll hear a lot of acronyms with this, but SIP is what it's called, but it's a State Improvement Plan. So actually, the state is presenting the plan, and the Environmental Improvement Board is considering that plan today. And if the EIB approves that plan, it will move on to the Environmental Protection Agency, which will review it, and that process will take about a year. Now, a bit of history. What had happened was the EPA had mandated that a plan be put into effect that would have required PNM to install costly environmental protections, environmental mitigation on the San Juan plant. All of the parties involved believed that this was not the best plan for New Mexico, that it only addressed one specific emission, didn't go far enough to help the environment, would have had too much of a rate impact on consumers, and would not give us the chance to go as far as we could in the best interest of New Mexico. So the governor was instrumental in talking with the EPA and getting them to allow us to meet with the EPA, the State Environment Department, and the stakeholders to try to come up with a plan that was better, that we felt was better. And in February, we did reach an agreement. And this agreement was reached among the EPA, the State of New Mexico, PNM, and other stakeholders. As you know, San Juan has multiple owners. PNM is the operating company, but it's owned by a number of utilities. And so we came to this agreement, which we feel is in the best interest of New Mexico, and that is to retire two of the four units at San Juan. And what that will do is it will reduce not only the emission that the EPA wanted us to reduce in the first place, but it goes farther and has more environmental protections, reduces another number of other emissions, including greenhouse gases. And this is significant because it will position PNM and the San Juan Generating Station to be better in better shape down the line for future EPA regulations regarding coal plants that we know are coming. And what that means is we have an expense now, and it will be a reduced expense down the road.
Is any decision forthcoming from the EIB based solely on PNM's presentation, or will other viewpoints be heard before a final determination is made?
Yes, it's an interactive process. The state will be presenting part of the testimony. PNM will be presenting technical testimony as far as our support of the plan. And there is a public comment where there are anybody that wants to speak can speak. And there's actually a format where attendees of the meeting can actually cross-examine the people presenting the testimony. So it's a very interactive and public process.
And let's talk about the PNM Navajo Nation Workforce Training Program. That's another component of this overall proposal. Tell us about that.
Well, we recognize that the plant has a big impact on the economy of the Four Corners region, in particular the Navajo Nation. Approximately 30% of the workforce at San Juan is Native American, and we want to make sure that we soften the economic blow to the area as much as possible. And we believe that by providing $1 million in funding over 5 years to the Navajo Nation for job training skills so that they can work in other areas such as the oil and gas industry up in the Four Corners and other businesses will help them moving forward.
And if PNM is indeed given the go-ahead to take these two units offline, will the company then have to seek a replacement energy source for them? And what form might that take? Say, some of PNM's growing renewables among its energy portfolio?
Ultimately, if this plan is approved, we'll have to replace about 340 megawatts of power. And we're considering a number of options for that replacement power. We are talking about the potential of building a natural gas-fired peaking plant in San Juan County, which would help the economy in the area as well. We're also looking at the possibility of adding additional solar and renewable resources. And we're also looking at the possibility of adding more nuclear power from our leases involving Palo Verde Nuclear Generating Station. So we're looking at a number of possibilities right now that will be determined going forward. And that's not something that's being considered at the hearing today. This hearing is solely about the plan itself to retire the two units at San Juan.
And is today's meeting the final determinant, or are there others still to come in the process?
No, this will be the final approval for the state. And if the EIB approves the plan, it will then move on to the Environmental Protection Agency, and that approval process will take about a year.
And is it possible a decision could come as soon as the conclusion of today's meeting?
You know, that's totally up to the EIB. In the past, they have decided at the end of the meeting, and other times they've taken longer, so we'll see.
Paul Shipley with PNM, many thanks for joining us here at noon on KSFR, which will continue in just a moment.
Programming on KSFR is underwritten in part by Medlin Mechanical, a full-service plumbing company specializing in green energy solutions for homes and business in the Santa Fe area for over 5 years. Medlin Mechanical's geothermal and solar systems are designed to cut energy costs and reduce carbon footprint. And tax credits for new systems are available through 2016. To learn more, visit medlinmechanical.com or call 577-8087. That's 577-8087.
16 minutes past the hour as At Noon continues. As our population ages, the number of people suffering from Alzheimer's disease is increasing. One of the tools that have been tried for diagnosing the devastating illness is the PET scan. We're now joined by Dr. Gary Rosenberg, who's the chairman of the Department of Neurology at UNM. Dr. Rosenberg, to begin, what exactly is a PET scan?
It's a imaging device that captures what's called positrons, positron emission tomography. Positrons emit two particles, two gamma particles, and they can be detected, and with fancy computerization, you can localize the, you can pinpoint the origin of the signal. It requires a cyclotron to generate the positron. It has to be then taken very quickly and connected up or somehow attached to the substance that you're looking for, and then inject it into the patient. So you have to have a cyclotron and a PET scan facility in order to be able to do it. So not too many places are able to do PET scans.
In your experience, is it a useful tool in diagnosing Alzheimer's?
I don't find it that useful. I think it's basically a research tool at this point. I think it's important to have a neurologist evaluate the patient, determine if there is some cognitive impairment, and then see if it's related to other diseases, medical diseases, hypertension, vascular disease, strokes, et cetera. And then the imaging test that's most useful and available is the MRI scan, which basically just shows that there's no other disease there. It's not diagnostic of Alzheimer's disease.
How about CT scanning? Is that helpful?
CT is an X-ray machine device, and it has a lot of, it's not very precise, and the bone which is very dense, gets in the way. It's not as accurate as the MRI scan. I don't think it's useful in Alzheimer's disease.
Traditionally, the physician's clinical impressions have been one of the keys to recognizing this disorder, have they not?
Oh, absolutely. It's a clinical diagnosis, and the machines are supportive but not diagnostic. I think it's important to have a neurologist evaluate the patient, determine if there is some cognitive impairment, and then see if it's related to other diseases, medical diseases, hypertension, vascular disease, strokes, etc. And then the imaging test that's most useful and available is the MRI scan, which basically just shows that there's no other disease there. It's not diagnostic of Alzheimer's disease. There are other tests now that are somewhat helpful. Examination of the cerebral spinal fluid with a lumbar puncture is used by some individuals to look for the protein that is involved in Alzheimer's disease, the amyloid protein. But again, that's not a diagnostic test. It's helpful.
And would you say this is a difficult disease to diagnose no matter what approach is taken?
The problem with Alzheimer's disease is that it begins probably 15 to 20 years before we're making the diagnosis. And these changes that are occurring in the brain, the deposition of these proteins, particularly the amyloid and another protein called tau, are beginning very early. So you can see these changes, but they don't necessarily help you determine who in the long run will get it, because they can also be present in some normal people.
With most illnesses, early diagnosis can lead to a better outcome. Is that also true with Alzheimer's?
Well, unfortunately, we don't understand completely the etiology of Alzheimer's disease, and we haven't found any treatments that stop the progression, which is really what everybody's working on very hard right now. So the treatments are basically to slow the process in terms of improving the memory. Some of the processes that are involved in memory can be affected by the drugs we use, but it doesn't impact the basic disease process that goes along on its own.
Dr. Rosenberg, what advice do you have for patients who are concerned about Alzheimer's disease, either for themselves or a family member?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of people who have memory problems, and that, of course, makes them think that they may have this disease, and that leads to anxiety and other forms of depression. In fact, depression itself can interfere with the memory. So I think the first thing to do is to see a neurologist trained in cognitive assessment and see if the memory loss that the patient is experiencing is actually part of the syndrome or due to something else, or even normal for aging. So one of the things is to not let the symptoms go without getting them checked if you're worried about them. So I think an evaluation by a competent neurologist is a good start to the understanding what's going on with your cognitive processes.
And anything that the general public can do to help deal with this disorder?
Well, I think that they probably should contact their representatives in the government and explain how important it is to maintain strong research program at NIH and other research facilities so we can find a cure for this disease, which is, as people age and we're all getting into the range of 80s and 90s, we're going to find a very large number of these people. And without a strong research program, without support from our senators in terms of providing funding for NIH, we don't have any chance. So I would encourage people to support in any way they can the research efforts.
Thank you, Dr. Gary Rosenberg, Chairman of the Department of Neurology at UNM.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by PNM, offering a way to support renewable energy on your bill with PNM Sky Blue. PNM customers can choose to pay a little more to support wind and solar energy efforts and show their commitment to the environment. If you have a question for PNM, you can talk to them on Twitter or Facebook, or learn more about PNM Sky Blue at PNM.com.
12:24 here in the KSFR newsroom as At Noon continues. Energy drinks. They've become enormously popular in recent years. They're sold virtually everywhere, promising consumers a quick pick-me-up. But their ingredients are not necessarily without any health risk. Joining us to talk more about this now is Dr. Stephen Seifer with the New Mexico Poison Control Center. Doctor, it may sound a bit alarming to our listeners to be contacting a poison center regarding what are sometimes referred to as health energy drinks. Can you outline some of the concerns regarding use of these beverages?
Well, most energy drinks contain caffeine. They contain caffeine in a variety of forms, some just added as a chemical, the way that colas have caffeine added to them. And then there are additional sources of caffeine in other ingredients that some of these drinks have, like cola nut, yerba mate, guarana, that are additional sources of not only caffeine but other compounds that may have other stimulatory effects. So that creates the potential, and whenever you have a drug, and caffeine is a drug, whenever you have a drug, you have to look at dose, who is being exposed to it, and the potential for both beneficial as well as adverse health effects.
So we would imagine then there are instances where folks unaccustomed to large amounts of stimulants like caffeine might imbibe one of these drinks and shortly thereafter discover they're not feeling well, yes?
Sure. The amount of caffeine in these drinks is highly variable. So depending upon the quantity ingested, sometimes one of these cans may have more than a single serving, for example. So a large can might have two or three servings in it. And if you drink the entire thing at one sitting, you may be getting a lot more caffeine than you intended. It depends on the context of the exposure. If it's an individual, an adult who goes in and buys a can, the amount of caffeine may be perfectly reasonable based on body weight. As you get into adolescence and children and young children, the amount of caffeine may be excessive. And if it's an accidental exposure, someone who wasn't intending to do that or has some pre-existing health problem that makes exposure to a certain amount of caffeine a problem, that's when you start to see adverse health effects. Some children, for example, are on other stimulatory medications for ADHD. It may seem a bit counterintuitive that a child with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is taking a stimulant, but in fact, amphetamines and related drugs are what are used to treat that condition. They assist in helping a child focus attention. But the clinical effects of caffeine will be generally additive to those medications, just as one example.
It sounds then as though the greatest precautions must be considered when we're talking about younger people.
The American Academy of Pediatrics has come out and stated flatly that there is no role for caffeine in the diet of children and adolescents. We recently completed a study of poison center data looking at exposures, reports of exposures to energy drinks in 2010-2011. And it's clear that children and adolescents, in fact, are being exposed to these products. The proportion of young children, those under the age of 6, in our database, is proportional to their exposure to other pharmaceuticals and other things, which would suggest that very young children are getting exposed accidentally, as they would to pills that are left out or other things around the house that may accidentally be ingested. Older children, those between 6 and 12, and adolescents, between which in our database takes them up to 20, have a disproportionate representation in our database, suggesting that they are in fact buying and using these products intentionally. And there is really no reason for doing that, and there are some potential risks. There's just no role for this in the diet of young children, older children, and adolescents.
Dr. Stephen Seifert at the New Mexico Poison Control Center, many thanks for joining us here at noon on KSFR. And we have more of At Noon coming up for you in just a moment.
The Women in Transition course at Santa Fe Community College provides women of all ages and backgrounds the tools to create a more positive future. Women in Transition offers practical information on topics like career building, financial independence, stress management, and more. The 7-week course meets Friday mornings from 9 to 10:50, starting September 6th on the SFCC campus. Partial tuition scholarships are available. To learn more, call 428-1486. That's 428-1486.
Here in September is when the farmers' almanacs usually come out, both the old and the original, as they competitively refer to themselves. They're well known for their long-range weather forecasts put together with natural observations, folklore, and arcane methods known only to the editors. But the National Weather Service office also works to keep tabs on upcoming atmospheric trends. The newest report on ENSO conditions is out. That's the measure of cooling or warming in equatorial Pacific Ocean waters that brings to the southwest either El Niño or La Niña. Niño tips us toward better chances for a wetter winter and spring. La Niña, drier conditions. Joining us now is meteorologist Clay Anderson with the National Weather Service office in Albuquerque. Clay, this latest report indicates that the winter months will bring neither a male nor a female child, yes?
Yeah, that's true. In terms of precipitation anomalies, generally we would be looking for one or the other, either El Niño or La Niña, to give us some confidence when it comes to, you know, long-term or long-range forecasting, seasonal forecasting of precipitation. So yeah, the Climate Prediction Center is currently forecasting higher probabilities for ENSO neutral conditions, meaning sea surface temperature anomalies in the eastern equatorial Pacific, to remain near neutral, meaning near zero, through the winter months. So they don't have any really strong indicators to lead them one direction or the other. So at this point, yeah, you're correct. We're saying it could go either way. We have equal chances, actually, of above or below normal precipitation across New Mexico.
Then whatever weather does come our way will be influenced by factors such as where the winter jet stream track decides to set up, things of that nature, correct?
Yeah, so that's a good point. You know, the sea surface temperature anomalies in the eastern equatorial Pacific have a large impact or effect on our atmospheric circulations and weather patterns. So absolutely, you know, if we're slightly positive in terms of our sea surface temperature anomalies, that can often produce a slightly different weather pattern, which could favor the jet stream dipping further south and more precipitation for New Mexico. That would be something we would be looking for, you know, going back into the mid-2000s, actually, if you think about the big snows that we had the winter of 2006-2007, we were in a mild El Niño that year. So, so that's something we would be looking for. Of course, that's not what's forecast, unfortunately, for us going into the winter months.
And another Pacific Ocean phenomenon that also plays a strong role in affecting southwestern U.S. precipitation is the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. Tell us about that.
The Pacific Decadal Oscillation is extremely important in terms of sea surface temperature anomalies and the interaction with El Niño or La Niña. But what's interesting to note is that the Pacific Decadal number that we monitor has been negative for the past, actually since late 2007. And generally speaking, whenever we have a negative number on the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, we end up with a suppression of wintertime precipitation here in New Mexico. So if you combine the fact that our Pacific Decadal Oscillation number is negative and has been for a while now, with this forecast of ENSO neutral conditions, meaning neither La Nina or El Nino, then it's kind of a negative outlook, actually, in terms of wintertime precipitation here. So as we head into the winter months, we really don't have anything that gives us confidence to forecast at or above normal precipitation.
And long-range forecasts can change often over time, but right here and now, we're in a drying trend. Is that the end of our summer monsoon, or might there still be more to come?
Yeah, so, you know, normally this time of year, as we get into the middle of September, we would be waving goodbye to the monsoon. And certainly it kind of looks that way right now with the lack of thunderstorm activity that we had Wednesday, the lack of thunderstorm activity that we're expecting today and into Friday, mainly due to the drying influences of an upper high that's sitting over southeastern Colorado. Now, that said, we are expecting another burst, actually a monsoonal burst of thunderstorms late in the weekend and into next week, actually up to around the start of the state fair. So, no, the answer is no. The monsoon's not over yet. We are expecting a return, and this is kind of normal, actually, in September. We'll have, you know, it'll go away for a while, then it'll come back one last burst, and then we'll get the westerlies kick in. The monsoon's over.
Meteorologist Clay Anderson with the National Weather Service office in Albuquerque, many thanks for joining us here at noon. 12:35 here at the news desk. Here, close to the bottom of the hour, is the perfect opportunity to spend 60 seconds with our resident curmudgeon, Christopher Hagan.
Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey said it was time to shut down gay conversion therapy for minors. If I were a minor, I wouldn't be happy until I was back above ground. Of course, we're talking age-wise minors and gay conversion therapy. That is such a strange-sounding phrase, gay conversion therapy. The concept and process sound, well, unnatural. The idea reminds me of left-handed conversion therapy. No, really. My mother was left-handed, and at the time that was considered unnatural. So the school system tried to get her to write right-handed. My mother never did, but she made her handwriting look like she wrote it right-handed, even though she wrote it left-handed. And I really have to hand it to my mother for having her left hand doing what the right hand should have been doing, and keeping the teachers from knowing the left from the right, I think. For KSFR, I'm Christopher Hagan.
And with that, we'll conclude today's edition of At Noon, KSFR's extended noon news hour. Dan Garrity with you here at the news desk. We'll be back tomorrow with more news of and for New Mexico for you. And as always, we hope you join us.